Since I arrived at Stephen Wise 8 years ago, I've used this occasion, Rosh Hashanah morning, to speak with you about Israel. Increasingly, I meet rabbis who tell me they no longer speak about Israel in their congregations. Israel has become too controversial, they say. Too many people get angry with me. Israel has become political, and the board doesn't want me to preach politics from the pulpit. I'm reminded of the story of the rabbi who suffered a mild heart attack, and when the president of the congregation visited him at the hospital, he sat down next to the rabbi, he grasped his hand in sympathy and said, "I have good news, Rabbi. The board just voted 12-8 to wish you a speedy recovery." Can we still talk about Israel? I want to explain to you why I speak about Israel every time at this year. I have a Jewish worldview that is driven by a few core principles. Irving Berlin was once asked, "How'd you manage to compose over 1,000 songs? Where did you find the creativity?" "If you listen closely," Berlin responded, "there are only 5 melodies in my head. All the rest are variations on the theme. I might produce 1,000 sermons during my career if I live long enough. But if you listen carefully, you'll only find a few core ideas in my head. All the rest are variations on the theme." Among these basic Jewish ideas are 1, I am committed to the survival and flourishing of the Jewish people. And 2, because I am committed to the survival and flourishing of the Jewish people, I am committed to the survival and flourishing of the Jewish state. These are not political statements, although they have political ramifications like anything important in life. These are religious principles that go to the heart of Jewish civilization. Not to speak of these principles, especially when they are under attack, is to abandon our Jewish responsibility. It is to surrender to intimidation or opposition or controversy. It is to follow when the call of the era is to lead. And I want our synagogue, the Stephen Wise Free Synagogue, in word, deed, and enthusiasm to lead and to stand for the unshakable commitment to these 2 principles, the survival and flourishing of the Jewish people and the flourishing of the Jewish state. We should so orient our programs, policies, pronouncements of this synagogue to reflect and further these high holy principles. You might recall that last January I organized and led an interfaith mission to Israel and the Palestinian territories, generously sponsored by 3 families in our congregation. Our main purpose was to model religious coexistence. We didn't harbor any illusions that we would discover some solution that has eluded everyone else. But we thought that our very presence, 15 senior American rabbis, ministers, and imams, might inspire us and others as well. That if we could coexist in America, why not also in the Middle East? We went to a border town overlooking the Gaza Strip. The separation barrier was in front of us with its imposing walls and barbed wire, and beyond, half of Gaza unfolded before our eyes. I had been to Gaza before during the heady days of peacemaking in the 1990s, but not since Hamas seized control in 2007. From afar, Gaza looked like any other place, with pastoral towns and idyllic villages. And I remember thinking, why over here and not over there? What causes one sliver of the earth to be democratic, prosperous, and free, and a neighboring sliver of the earth to be undemocratic, unprosperous, and unfree? Is it climate? Is there something different in the air? Surely not. The climate over here is the same as the climate over there, less than a mile away. Is it natural resources? Does the land produce something over here that doesn't produce over there? Surely not. There are no natural resources over here and over there. But over here, the desert blooms, and over there, the desert spreads beyond the horizon. Is it in the biological makeup of the people? Are the people over here in some way genetically different? Do they have democratic DNA? Surely not. We are the same. People are the same. Human biology is the same everywhere. So what is the difference? If you say, as is so common amongst the Palestinian people themselves and their supporters around the world, it is the occupation. It is the Israeli occupation. Occupation prevents prosperity and freedom. If you say this, then you are onto something. You are not completely wrong. Limited travel, limited transportation, limited mobility, tight border controls, and regular spasms of violence, a blanket of fear that is spread over the skies of life, these are not conducive to and do inhibit freedom and prosperity. But you are only partially right. You cannot ignore your own responsibility for this. You cannot ignore your own responsibility in causing Israel's determined response to protect its citizens. And you cannot ignore decades of Israeli peace proposals and decades of your rejection. And you are only partially right for this reason as well. Why is it where there is no Israeli presence at all that people still languish in poverty and despair? Why in Lebanon? Why in Syria? Why in Egypt? Why in Iraq? Why in Iran? There are no Israelis there. Why over here and not over there? You know, on this day when our embassies are being attacked all over the world, we can ask the question anywhere in the world. Why in the United States and not in the United Arab Emirates? Why in Detroit and not in Damascus? Why in Toledo and not in Tehran? Why in Cannes and not in Cairo? Why Berlin and not Bahrain? And for that matter, why Berlin 2012 and not Berlin 1940? Why have millions of refugees, homeless and penniless, including our own ancestors, come to these shores from those shores and made it while those stayed behind did not? Do they undergo some bodily metamorphosis when they come here? The difference is not in our physical constitution, but in our constitutional principles. The difference is not in our potential, but in a society that allows our potential to reach its fullest expression, a society that values freedom, dignity, progress, tolerance, diversity, pluralism, religious coexistence, and peace. As the 15 of us stood on the observation point, I noticed beyond the separation wall, several hundred yards into Gaza, there was a pile of rubble strewn about with one building intact amidst the rubble. And when I asked, what is that building and why is it still intact? I was told that this was the synagogue of an evacuated Israeli settlement that Hamas left behind and left intact so that the people could go in there and dance in victory. If I had a chance to speak with these Hamas leaders, which I don't, and if they would lend me an ear, which they won't, here's what I would say. You contend that you are implacably opposed to a Jewish state. You vow to the end to fight Israel to the end and to destroy her. You say that every action that you take is legitimized by your struggle. Your official documents declare that your goal is jihad and the death of Jews. You believe that all Muslims are duty-bound to jihad against Israel. You say that the land of Palestine is an Islamic inheritance and that peace is not an option. You say that Western culture is a Zionist plot to distance Islamic women from Islam. You are in league with the world's most extreme rejectionists. Iran and Hezbollah are your allies. Israel is a cancer, said Ayatollah Khamenei, Iran's supreme leader. And in language that even Hitler would approve, Iran's President Ahmadinejad said that the very existence of the Zionist regime is an insult to humankind and an affront to all of the world's nations, while 500,000 Iranians cheered every genocidal word. I would say to Hamas leaders, these are your allies and comrades in arms. You will not support a Jewish state. You will not negotiate peace with Israel. And you will fight to the end to destroy her. You shoot missiles and perpetrate terror. And then you accuse Israelis of unprovoked aggression when they respond to protect themselves. You commit murder and throw yourself at the mercy of the Court of International Opinion, pleading protection from the Israeli aggressor. Really? You cross into the backyard to murder and you complain when they build a fence to prevent you from coming again? What will convince you? What will persuade you? You've told us. Nothing but complete surrender. You have clarified that there is no other way to satisfy your demands. There is no other way to placate you. Israel's very being is the problem. You say that you will allow the surrendering Jews to leave, to go to Europe or America or any other country that will accept them. You don't care where they go as long as they go. You offer them the choice. Stay and be killed or leave. To be or not to be. This is your proposal. For you, upon this principle, the entire struggle rests. Your solution to the problem is that Israel should not be. Can Israel agree to that? Not to be? Can the free world yield to this demand? Can we do this? We cannot. There is no middle ground between being and not being. I would say to Hamas leaders, know that sooner or later you and your kind will be defeated. Despite your best efforts to slander and delegitimize Israel, Israel is not alone. And in the end, you will be defeated by your own people who say, enough! Enough to rejection. Enough to violence. Enough to extremism. We choose progress and peace. On the last day in Israel, our interfaith clergy delegation visited with Salam Fayyad, the prime minister of the Palestinian Authority, in his Ramallah office. I had been to Ramallah many years before when it was the headquarters of Yasser Arafat, and I remembered the city to be dusty and poor. There was not a lot of activity there. Now, Ramallah is bustling and bursting at the seams. Construction is everywhere. Palestinian neighborhoods are expanding and new towns are being built nearby. With international assistance, Israeli help, and most importantly, as a result of their own strategic decision to lay down their arms and lift up the economy, it is exciting to see how much has changed for the better in Ramallah. They told us that many Palestinians in Ramallah reject the ways of their compatriots in Gaza. They want computers, not guns. We spent an hour with Prime Minister Fayyad. He was under enormous pressure. The president of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, was leading a diplomatic effort against Israel, having just lost his bid in the United Nations to declare its support for unilateral Palestinian statehood, contrary to the Camp David Accords that called for the parties themselves to negotiate a permanent settlement. Fayyad, who is less powerful than Abbas, doesn't support this kind of diplomatic warfare. He wants to build up the Palestinian economy in preparation for statehood. He wants to build bridges of cooperation, not to burn the bridges. And I remember thinking, if I could speak with President Abbas and other leaders of the Palestinian Authority, which we actually can do nowadays, and if they would listen, and they may actually do nowadays. Here's what I would say. Are you with Fayyad or Hamas? Are you with the peacemakers or with the rejectionists? You waver between the two. If you are with the rejectionists, then this long struggle will continue because it is not then a territorial dispute that can be resolved. It is a struggle for survival that must be won by defeating the aspirations of the other side. If, however, you are with the peacemakers, we have common aspirations, and we could be allies, we could be partners. Most Israelis will be with you. Three times in the last 12 years, Israeli governments have put generous peace proposals on the table, and three times in the last 12 years, the majority of Israelis approved. And three times in the last 12 years, you, the Palestinian Authority, rejected these proposals, and Arafat even launched a deadly war in the cities of Israel. You're working hard to delegitimize Israel in every international forum that you can find. You're unprepared even to acknowledge an ancient Jewish presence in the land of Israel. There never was a Jewish kingdom in the Holy Land, is your contentious contention. It was all made up by the Zionists. In this, you are the international equivalent of the birthers. Contemptuous of the truth. Oblivious to the facts, you deny all evidence of the Jewish people being born in the land of Israel. Show us the birth certificate, you say. And when presented with mountains of incontrovertible evidence, you argue the birth certificate is fake. Show us the long-form birth certificate and bring us eyewitnesses to the live birth. As if 3,000 years ago, some locals in the Near East cooked up a conspiracy that would materialize 30 centuries later to hoodwink the people who only in the 20th century came to define themselves as Palestinians. Tell me, if President Obama cannot convince the American birthers with an actual document from 50 years ago, how can anyone convince you? I would say to the leaders of the Palestinian Authority, don't hitch your wagon to the extremists in your party. Don't run to the United Nations. That's not where the important decisions will be made. Don't expect to impose upon Israel international arrangements contrary to your promises at Camp David. You need to decide for yourselves whether full peace in less territory is better than no peace in more territory. I would say to the leaders of the Palestinian Authority, as you well know, the outline of the agreement has already been negotiated. You discussed it together with Prime Minister Olmert in 2007 and 2008, with perhaps minor changes. It is the same broad outline that was negotiated at Camp David that you rejected. Neither side will receive everything at once. Both sides need to make painful concessions. What is left now is for the respective leaderships to take the hard decisions. I would say to the leaders of the Palestinian Authority, you should know that most Israelis and supporters of Israel around the world do not want to fight with you. We want to live with you. Most of us support painful compromises for true peace, not a piece of paper. Not an arrangement that is simply a stepping stone to the next war, but full and final peace. Long ago, we realized there's no other way. Long ago, we realized that the Palestinians are going nowhere and the Israelis are going nowhere. Long ago, we realized that we shall either find a way to live together in peace or we shall die together in pieces. I would say to the leaders of the Palestinian Authority, we too have extremists in our midst. It is true. The Jews who firebombed a Palestinian taxi last month are terrorists and a disgrace to Judaism. Those in the Jewish mob who lynched a Palestinian youth in the heart of Jerusalem last month are contemptible. We cringe with embarrassment at these errant weeds. Prompts us to reflect how damaging this war with you has been. Three generations of Israelis and three generations of Palestinians have been raised on war. It saps the moral energy from both whose passions should be directed towards construction, not destruction. We want the next generation to prove its ingenuity not on the battlefield, but in the fields of medicine, science, technology, art, music, theater, literature. And I would say to the members of the Palestinian Authority, choose the way of Salam Fayyad and build. Stop traveling the world complaining about Israel. Sit in Ramallah and talk. Meet the Israeli people halfway, and you will find there a majority for peace. It's no fantasy. It is the record of peacemaking. Every single time that the right hand of peace was extended by an Arab leader, Israelis grasped it. Once Anwar Sadat traveled to Jerusalem and spoke directly with the Israeli people, 30 years of animosity melted away in one evening. For you who live in Ramallah, Jerusalem is only a 20-minute drive. Take that road. It is the way forward. After 4.5 physically exhausting and mentally draining days, but days of enormous uplift and religious energy as well, the 15 of us returned home to the same landscape that we left. And I remember thinking, how now to communicate to American Jews to stay involved, stay engaged, and remain committed to Israel, one of the great wonders of the world, and the greatest and most eloquent collective expression of Jewish peoplehood in our days? I say to you again, whatever you as an individual believes is between you and your conscience or your maker. But our communal duty is clear. The survival and flourishing of the Jewish people through, in part, the survival and flourishing of the Jewish state. Let us honor our duty effectively and fearlessly. Most American Jews are progressive in our thinking. In the history of human affairs, progressives have made enormous contributions. We can imagine better days. Days when the lion lies down with the lamb, days when all shall sit under their vines and fig trees and none shall be afraid. Progressives can imagine former enemies making peace. When they shall beat their swords into plowshares and spears into pruning hooks. We can imagine a world of hope conquering fear, peace defeating war, life vanquishing death. And because we can imagine these things, we have often succeeded, despite long odds, in bringing them about. Progressives are persuaded by logic. We are convinced by reason. We are confident that other people are reasonable too. That if there continues to be conflict, it is because we have not yet found the bridging mechanism, that one convincing argument that will persuade the other side to be reasonable. And thus, we are prone to exaggerating the potential of progressivism. We're always shocked to discover how many people do not think like us. They do not respond to logic and reason, at least not ours that is steeped in Western philosophy. They do not believe in live and let live. They do not aspire to democracy. They do not believe in human rights. They are not pluralists. Characteristic of progressive thinking is our impatience with slow change. We believe in rapid progress. That's why we're called progressives. And because of this, we are especially prone to discouragement and disillusion when the world does not unfold as we expect. We need to fight this despondency with all of our energies. Peace is not some pre-existing condition that existed before our time and that all we need to do is extend our hand and grasp it. For most of human history, it was peace that was the aberration, not war. Peace is the result of incalculable energy invested by countless people over many centuries, and if peace endures, it is the result of unrelenting vigilance. While the impulse to violence exists in all of us, in truth, it is more powerful in some of us. And while violence exists in all societies, in truth, it is more acceptable in some. How else to explain the following statement from Hassan Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah? Death means nothing but happiness. The Jews love life, he said. We're going to win because they love life and we love death. There is no killer argument for a killer. A killer is driven by human impulses that are beyond reason. You cannot reason a person out of something that they have not reasoned themselves into in the first place. And therefore, let us insist on clear-eyed progressivism, not the fairy tale version spun out of the imaginations of so-called intellectuals and professional critics whose self-proclaimed righteousness is often nothing but self-righteousness and whose moral tirades often reveal deep moral confusion. We cannot allow ourselves to be distracted or diverted by the sophisticated contrivances of those who ply us with corroded concepts and prostituted principles. We are the true progressives. We cannot be with so-called human rights activists who are silent when a terrorist kills a Jewish baby, but are apoplectic when Israel kills the terrorist. Who said nothing when the murderer crossed the hilltop, but rage when the security barrier goes up on the hill. This is not human rights. Human rights are not selective or severable. Human rights are indivisible and universal. Israelis are entitled to human rights too. We cannot be with so-called humanitarians who are silent when the missiles are launched into Israel, but protest when Israel launches back. This is not humanitarianism. If they were really concerned with civilian casualties, they would have protested when the missiles killed and maimed Israelis, not only the Israeli response against the perpetrators. To protest only the Israeli response and not the initial attack. And the failure to distinguish between the purposeful targeting of civilians and accidental death is hypocrisy, not humanism. Israelis are human beings too. We cannot be with so-called defenders of liberty who have said not a word, have not written a single article, organized a single march, convened a single academic or student conference about the slaughter in Syria, the mass murder of children, civilians, and innocents, but who continue to obsess about every perceived minor violation of Israeli democratic norms. Israel is a Western democracy. Flawed in some significant respects. All democracies are flawed. But representing Western values, all of its neighbors, every single last one of them, as far as the eye can see, are authoritarian. To ignore this fundamental reality of the Middle East is libel, not liberty. We cannot be with so-called defenders of human dignity when they have said not a word, not written a single article, organized a single march, convened a single academic or student conference about the genocide that Iran threatens while haranguing us about Israel's concern that Iran will soon go nuclear. Israelis are entitled to life and dignity too. We cannot be with those who, in the name of progress, would take us backwards, who, in the name of perfecting democracy, would strangle the only democracy in the Middle East, who, in the name of peace, would boycott and sanction the one state in the Middle East that from its creation has extended the hand of peace and has actually conceded territory that it won in defensive wars. It's not the criticism of Israel that is the issue. There are no more critical people in the world than Jews. Pluralistic cultures like Judaism rest on the assumption of argumentation and criticism. Dispute, controversy, disagreement. These are the paths to truth, according to our sages. And democracies, too, rest on the assumption of protest and opposition. Only monolithic religious cultures and totalitarian political cultures fear dissent. For us, we welcome it. What we fear is apathy. It's not the criticism of Israel that is the issue. It is the intent, the effect, and the context of the criticism. Our communal concern is the survival and flourishing of the state of Israel. If the intent, effect, and context of the discussion is about that, the more public discourse, the better. The more disagreement, the better. The more criticism, the better. From anywhere, Jews or Gentiles, Israelis or others, in our synagogue, we have hosted proponents of a broad spectrum of opinion on Israel. If, however, the intent, effect, or context of the discussion is about the very existence of Israel, if the attack is a broad indictment on the legitimacy of Israel, know that its purpose is to make war on the very idea of the Jewish state, and is sometimes, not always by any means, but sometimes seeped in anti-Semitism or self-hatred. And as a community, cannot be with them. We cannot support them. We cannot give them a platform, and we cannot give them aid and comfort. Where do we go from here? We stay on the road to peace. How long is that road? We cannot say. We cannot see the end of the road. It is beyond the horizon. It is still many years away. We will have many dangerous moments ahead. The road is fraught with hardship and sacrifice. There will be days of despair and even desperation. There will be many failures. Failures of our own making and the failures of others. There are times that I too feel tired. Tired of the lives wasted. Tired of the slow progress. Tired of this struggle that never seems to end. Tired of the work it takes just to stay alive in a tiny corner of the world. Tired of the timidity of leaders. Tired of the hypocrisy. Tired of the duplicity. Tired of fear. Tired of senseless hatred. Tired of being misunderstood. Tired of misunderstanding others. Tired of our children being buried before their time, and tired of watching them bury their children before their time. But in my weariness, I remain enormously grateful to be alive at this moment in time, to witness with my own eyes the millennial hope of the Jewish people to be restored to its home in the land of Zion and in Israel. Israel is an inspiration. It represents hope. It says to the world entire, if the Jews can do it, after all that the Jews endured, others can dare to hope as well. And even in my most depleted moments, seems that I can hear the words of the prophet Isaiah ringing down on me from the heavens. God gives strength to the weary, and to those who feel depleted, he gives courage. As eagles grow new plumes, so shall they run and not grow faint. They shall march on and not grow tired.